A thing that looks like a police box standing in a junkyard. It can move anywhere.
Haven, concentrate on Sim. Give priority to the detectors and the navigation systems.
There is a corridor. And the corridor is time. It surrounds all things.
On display, I eventually had to go down to the cellar.
That's the display department.
With a torch.
The lights are probably gone.
So had the stairs.
Yours is number 6.
I am not a number. I am a person.
Welcome to British Invaders, episode 78. This is the podcast all about British science fiction television, and today we are talking about Ultraviolet. This is Brian from Canada.
And Eric from Canada.
And Ilona from Canada.
And this is a slightly different configuration and different style of episode for us today, with a different team. Instead of having Eamon from England podcasting with me, I have a couple of guests, so we have an all-Canadian team, so something a little bit different. Michael's best friend, Jack, disappears right before his own wedding, doesn't show up at the altar. What has happened to Jack? At first, no one is quite sure.
And then, as Michael starts to investigate the disappearance of his partner and best friend, he uncovers not one, but two conspiracies of one sort or another. Shadowy groups moving behind the scenes of the normal world, if he knew it.
Is it supernatural, or is it just something that's typically normal, everyday police work?
Those are definitely open questions at the beginning. And as this is a science fiction podcast, you might have an idea about that. And Ultraviolet was a 1998 Channel 4 series that ran for 6 episodes, about 50 minutes each. Channel 4 does run commercials, so it was commercial television in the UK. Going a little bit more into the setup of Ultraviolet, after some investigation, it seems that Jack may be a Code 5, and Michael gets involved with this small hunting or investigation-type organization that is, we think, somehow connected to the government, and we follow what happens with Michael as he chases after Jack and other things as well.
And we also follow the moral questions that Michael struggles with, that these Code 5s, as you may have heard, are maybe some kind of what we would call vampire. Are they still human? Do they still have a soul? These are things he wrestles with as the series goes on.
What is a Code 5, you might ask? Well, a Code 5, or sometimes affectionately called by characters in the show as a leech, is essentially a vampire, even though they may not use the word. It does hold to most of the vampire legend, examples burning in sunlight, stake by wood, and does tend to convert new followers to a boy, though it's not seen in any episode, but the evidence is there. Other things is possible, they don't show up on videos, or on film, or in mirrors, which is another classic sign of a vampire in order to prove that they are soulless. Interestingly enough, I found that the Code 5 had to use its voice synthesizer to communicate over the phone, which extends the soullessness of the vampire. As an extension of this, it's probably safe to say that these Code 5 would not be able to enter into anything that uses camera, like automated doors. However, this is also considered an infection, which is only visible by ultraviolet light and can be eradicated, giving the show's name Ultraviolet. A Code 5 also uses science and technology and medicine to help purify the blood, because they find that the infection is a pollution of their food source.
Now, what we're getting into here is the idea that Ultraviolet is a modernized version of the vampire myth. And this is sort of its trademark, is that it's a very modern type of view on it, and that they never actually mention the word vampire. Code 5 is, of course, the Roman numeral 5, so V. But it is something we get into that's kind of interesting, that there is a great deal of science and technology and medical research that comes into play that the Code 5s are doing themselves.
And that, they, as Mona commented, that they're trying to keep their food supply pure, that if people who have blood disorders are really a problem for them in the future.
Yes, they get into the idea of the Code 5s treating humans as a food source, almost as cattle, with the idea that blood diseases and cancer and things like this to the 5s are pollution problems rather than medical problems. It's a question of keeping their food supply in a pure and healthy state. We also, of course, wonder about these investigators who has Michael joined up with? Well, we don't know a lot about them. We know the individual characters, and we'll get into those shortly. But we don't know a lot about who is controlling them or what their mission is. We do get the feeling that they have ties and backing from the government, and also ties to the Catholic Church, and probably money coming from the Catholic Church as well. And there is a lot of high technology and medical research on that side as well. And they do have this idea that the Code 5s, at least one-to-one, outmatch the humans. So because of that, the team tends to approach the Code 5s on a shoot-first approach. And you get the idea, well, is this investigation team really just a death squad?
But the death squad question is interesting in that the Code 5s are not killed in this show. They have turned to dust, which the characters of this team know can be reanimated. So they call a prison where all of the Code 5s that are encountered are stored, where the ashes are stored.
That's right. They refer to them as being immortal. And part of the reason for that is that if they are neutralized, rather than killed, neutralized by either ultraviolet light or being staked through the heart or shot through the heart with a wooden or carbon fiber bullet, they turn into ashes, but the ash can be reanimated, which is why this team is always collecting those ashes and keeping them in a high-security freezer, essentially.
But repeatedly, the Code 5s, when I make comments about the hero, the protagonist's team, call them the Death Squad, which is quite a misnomer, at least in this opinion.
Yes, that is a point.
I did find that they used an interesting way to keep them stored, and I did enjoy the fact that they used the freezer aspect, which was quite an added bonus to see that they were actually trying to keep the ashes instead of just disseminating them, because as you disseminate the ash, typical myth, that would mean they would not be able to reanimate. So okay, Keeping them together is kind of almost like a burial rite in its own sense, as if sticking them in cold storage is more of a
prison. Yeah.
Not really a prison. It's more of a way to say goodbye and yet still keep them close.
Interesting. Going on to look at some of the characters. The central character was definitely Detective Sergeant Michael Caulfield. And Michael, or just Mike, was a police detective at the beginning of the series, but when his friend Jack disappears, he of course starts investigating that on his own, which is when he starts poking around with the investigation team that goes after the Code 5s. And it was through this poking around that he, in that first episode, joins the investigation team. And it was in part because they specifically wanted to have someone who was a policeman and an investigator as part of their team. So that is his role in many ways, as being the investigation side of this team more than the others. And also that he's new to this, so he's still learning, and he has moral questions about it more than the others do. So he is always wondering whether they're really doing the right thing and whether the Code 5s are really evil and really should be hunted.
And as the new to the team, he's also in the eyes of the audience asking these questions that the audience would like to know as well about the organization and the Code 5s.
Absolutely.
The second character, Dr. Angie Marsh, played by Susanna Parker, is a very scientific-based individual. She doesn't jump to conclusions. She's there to be the science behind the team. At first, her character seems a little too aloof, but as the series progresses, you get a feeling as to why. It goes on to show that her family is what she's there to protect, alongside all of her friends that she needs to make sure that they're safe. She uses her scientific mind to help eradicate problems from the future. She cares a lot about her co-workers, and she is really based on her job. She tended to be, like I said, a very aloof at first, but as the series progressed, you can start seeing that her heart isn't as cold as it's as you once thought it was. She's hiding something behind a wall of steel to make sure that she doesn't wind up getting hurt any more than she already is.
Angie Marsh definitely was an interesting character, and it's partly through her character that we learn that everyone involved in this investigation team has lost someone to the Code Fives, and that becomes an important part of her character.
Susanna Harker will go on to keep going with the director of Joe Ahern with the movie Trance later, starring in that, as well as many other British science fiction projects that we know about.
Yeah, Susanna Harker has done quite a bit of British television. She first became well-known with a serial quite a number of years ago now called House of Cards, which was a political drama. And that was a big thing for her. And then she went on to a number of other things like this, like Ultraviolet. And she's been involved with Big Finish in their audio releases on a number of titles as well.
Up next is Vaughn Rice by Idris Elba. He's sort of, if Michael is the good cop in the series, and Vaughn is the bad cop, he wastes no time when dealing with the leeches, as he calls them. Just, no question, just fire a bullet, and that'll solve the problem. Idris has gone on to many other things. So he started off in Space Precinct back in 94. He was then in 28 Weeks Later and in The Office, and there'll be the new Thor movie coming up. So he's still quite the involved person, doing a bit of producing as well.
Space Precinct, wow, that was a live-action Gerry Anderson series.
Yeah. Okay, oh, and a little more on Vaughn. He was a former soldier, and again, as was noted, he lost people to the Code Fives, and he was the last survivor of a troop of soldiers, only because the sun went up. He seems to have some deeper connection to Dr. Marsh, but it's never really explained. But it's part of the mystery. Well, next is Father Pierce J. Harmon, played by Philip Quast. He is the leader of this group of CIB, they call themselves. He was a practicing priest, but after a Code 5 attack, then he became a vampire hunter. Oops, I didn't say the word. He has
okay.
Decades of experience, and how he sort of looked up to as sort of the voice of experience. He doesn't dress as a priest, as far as I can tell, but it seems to have still the usual sort of a bane effect on these Code Fives, which is an interesting mystery about them.
Yes, Pierce was an interesting character, in part because he brings a very specific set of morals and beliefs to the table from the Christian side of things, being a priest, that is at times used in quite interesting ways. Getting into some of the characters who are less in the inner circle, Francis Pembroke, played by Fiona Dolman, was a confidant of Michael's, and she was someone who was not directly involved in anything related to the Code Fives, but she is an investigator of some sort and also deals in, apparently, some things that are rather secret as well. Frequently, as Michael is learning how to be involved in a secret organization and investigating and doing other things, he is going to Francis to have someone on the outside who can run little favors for him and do some little investigation on the side, and also someone he can go to for advice. And they do certainly make it clear that the two of them were a couple at some point, and are not really at the time this takes place, but were at some point. So there's some chemistry and some involvement there as well.
I had a feeling that she was most also like a psychologist in a way, that he would be able to go to bear his troubles to her. Maybe not full-on disclosure, but at least had someone outside the group that he can talk to.
Yes.
And being on the outside also had the benefit that he had tried to detach himself from everyone else that he knew, including the fiancé that
Kirsty,
in from episode one. So she, Francis, was also then sort of the messenger that he was trying to console Kirsty from the incident.
But she's like his last link to his old life and to outside, you know, more familiar things.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Kirsty Main, played by Colette Brown. I guess a lot of people would know her as of lately. She was seen in Torchwood. Colette Brown was seen in Torchwood in 2008. She has been in several other series and movies of late, so she is pretty active. The character of Christy Main is a woman who I see as grieving. She's grieving her life. In the first episode, you pretty much see her lose everything in her life except for Michael to a disaster. Her greatest day of her life to that point is ruined. She is dealing with grief, and throughout the entire series, you see her deal with this grief. It's very, very apparent that she is upset. She lost her fiancé, she's lost this, she's lost that, and now she's dealing with this. So as you see her go forward through the series, she is trying to get over this problem of being grieving, and eventually she does wind up finding solace in the arms of someone else. But as this happens, she loses the last remaining link to Jack, her fiancé, which actually I found was pretty interesting when he was played by Stephen Moyer of True Blood fame, Bill Compton, which makes him a serial vampire there. but it shows how deep she loved this man, and she would have to go through all the steps of grieving, and every single episode showed her go through yet another step of the grieving process.
And she grieves also that Michael had to pull himself away, that they were pretty good friends as well.
Yeah.
That she is angry that he's had to step away.
Yes, because of the interactions that she does have with Michael, it's clear to her that she is on the outside of something. And Michael knows something about Jack and why he's gone that she doesn't know. And Michael is pushing Kirsty away. So for Kirsty, she's in this situation where she finds herself shut in the outside of something that she wants to know about, because it's clear that it involves what happened to her fiancé.
Do you know where Jack is?
Yeah, like I'm going to tell you.
You should. We're all on the same side. You must know by now what we're dealing with.
No, I know what you think you're dealing with. I can't help that.
You believe Jack is still your friend?
Well, whatever he's done, he doesn't deserve a death sentence.
I'm afraid that was carried out 3 nights ago, before you last met.
Now, getting into a few production details, the writer and director, Joe Ahern, wanted to make something different. He didn't want to do a typical television show with lawyers or police or sort of the standard kinds of things they were doing a lot of at the time. And he noticed that British drama had not done that much with vampires, especially vampire stories outside of the Dracula story. Certainly in the 1970s, Hammer Horror was doing a lot of vampire films, but most of them were Dracula-related. And he liked this idea of doing an update to the vampire myth, of saying, well, vampires now in today's society, science would be involved, both for the vampires and the people going after the vampires. And you wouldn't have the classic idea of the hunt in the same way. It would be more of a war between the vampires and the humans opposing the vampires.
Joe Ahern had been writing a lot of one-off screenplays when his agent suggested that he write a series instead. And what Brian was saying about the vampire myth, changing it from war instead of hunt, you get a very good sense of this in the series with people dressing as if they are to go to war, carrying heavy artillery around, using trucks to mobilize to go after the vampire. It's not so much the hunt as a game of big cat and mouse, except you can't really tell who the cat is and who the mouse really is.
That's right. It does have a bit of a cat chasing cat kind of feel to it. And they do, in a lot of cases, go for a rather military look there as well.
Mm-hmm. There's SWAT teams that the CIB seems to be able to mobilize, get their masks and their
yes.
Yes. And their big weapons, especially in the first... It's evident in the first episode, but it gets more advanced as it goes along. The production of Ultraviolet was done by World Productions for Channel 4. And it was very popular in the UK, very well received, and in so much so, it was brought over to North America on the Sci-Fi Channel broadcast, and we were very lucky that Sci-Fi decided to broadcast the original UK version as a three-part miniseries. I was not able to see that, but I'm assuming that if they were bringing it over as an original UK version, that they would not have cut anything else out, which tends to be the norm for a lot of things that are brought over. Things are cut out, things are changed, things are messed a little bit with.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it was cut down or not. It may have been cut down a little bit, but it was certainly close to the original edits. And they did it as this sort of three-part setup rather than six, which, as far as I know, worked reasonably well. I have not seen that version. But the interesting thing was that around the same time, they were also looking at the possibility of doing an American remake of Ultraviolet. And they did produce a pilot. It was done for Fox Television. It starred Eric Tall, Lisa Goeng, and Madchen Amick, along with Idris Elba reprising his role of Von Reis. And it was actually after they completed the pilot that they asked Joe Ahern, the original writer, director, creator, if he wanted to contribute to the new American version. And he actually declined. He wasn't interested in contributing to that. But the producer of the American one, Howard Gordon, said that he didn't like the results of the pilot production. He just didn't think the episode they produced was all that good. So in the end, it was abandoned, and they didn't do an American version, which may be just as well, because the British one stands up fairly well.
And so many people be asking, why wasn't there a second season of Ultraviolet if it was so popular? Well, unfortunately, this is mainly the brainchild of one man, Joe Ahern. He was the writer and director, so that was a burning task, overloading him with that. And so normally, apparently, you'd be writing the second season for a series. The writer would be busy while the first series is being shot. Well, he didn't have a chance in this case, and so there wasn't anything to present to the network right away. And then he immediately was pulled on other projects like Trance that we had talked about, and then some other films. And then by that time, there were these other projects that come out. And
yes, sometimes when you have one person who is so heavily embroiled in the project, writing all six episodes, directing all six episodes, creating it, and coming up with the ideas initially, it does become sometimes a challenge to sustain that over multiple years. And by the time it was out there and successful, it was a bit of a challenge to try to get things back together. And I don't think they had made any particular provisions for having a second season.
And in interviews, Ahern had said he had fought and he got what he considered a satisfying conclusion at the end of this six-part series, that they didn't scream for a sequel. He said he could write one if the conditions were right, but
but it's there. There is a hook that you could go on to a second season.
They opened a big arc, a possibility.
Yes.
Absolutely, but the first series, the one that was actually produced, has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And it ends with an examination of, well, what are the Code Fives actually doing and what are their motivations? There is something of a reveal at the end, and it does come to a conclusion, where a second series certainly could be there, but it would be something of a separate entity. It would be like another chapter after the first one was complete.
Then of a note, it might be worth noting it, this is Ultraviolet, the 1998 TV series from the UK. There was a feature film called Ultraviolet in 2006, but it has nothing to do with this series. Trust me. There's no character named Violet in this television series. Just I was researching this. This was one of the things that came up that they say, Ultraviolet, 1998. No, there's no character named Violet here.
You do have, in some cases, multiple things with the same names, and you certainly have that here. So I think that covers it for the first half of our Ultraviolet discussion. Next time, we will talk more about some of the individual stories and maybe even a little bit about the world that this is set in and a little more about the Code Fives.
And we will give our own comments and talk about availability and also accessibility.
And we will, of course, be going on with this special format of our three-person panel with an all-Canadian team. And after that next episode, we'll be going back to our more regular team and format of our Canadian and British panel. You can reach us at BritishInvaders@gmail.com, and you can find us at www.BritishInvaders.com. We have a Facebook group, so if you search for British Invaders on Facebook, you will find us there. So thank you for listening, and this is Brian from Canada, signing off.
I'm Lana from Canada, signing off.
And Eric from Canada, signing off.